This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome to the championship edition of the Division 2, Division 3 podcast. What a weekend at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia. We have first-time champion Cabrini winning the NCAA title 16-12 against Amherst. The headline that we put on the website was a storybook ending for Cabrini, and really it was just a season of adversity and just guys stepping up and really couldn't write a better season than Cabrini had. Merrimack is going out of Division II with the title. They beat Limestone 16-8, a pretty decisive win against the South Power. And they are going to Division I next year with the D2 title in hand. Kyle, we were there. Josh was also there, kind of opposite us, at the Lincoln Financial Field. And what a weekend it was. Kyle, what's your overall impression of the weekend?
I mean, it's the perfect mix of triumph and heartbreak for me. Like, just in terms of, obviously, I know the North teams better. So I had a stronger connection to them, and one won and one didn't. And, you know, last year we were kind of building towards that kind of period, and both North teams kind of won. So I didn't get that, like, kind of sick feeling I got when Amherst lost this weekend. I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't ready because I didn't realize how much, like, you know, personal stake I think we all have in the game, not even in Amherst winning, but, like, I felt like in both cases, the other team could have won, and I would have totally seen how and why, and I would have felt for the team that lost because I would have had the same feeling for them. So it's a confusing kind of emotional experience because it all happens in one day. I mean, I talked to both, you know, Mike Morgan and John Thompson after the win and the loss, respectively. It's hard to talk to, like, see someone go through that sort of pain, but also, like, you know, it'll charge you up to see, like, a champion, like, really appreciate being a champion. And, you know, Morgan definitely does, and I'm sure Thompson would have. But yeah, it was a very emotional weekend for sure. And one I won't forget for a very long time.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was cool to see two first-timers in the D3 side. You know, I think Cabrini represents that there's hope for some of those teams that have not made it, right? We've talked about how there's been so few teams that have actually just broken through to championship weekend at all, let alone won a championship. And I think Cabrini is a really good example of, like, one of those smaller liberal arts schools tucked away in the corner of, you know, Pennsylvania that has made it work. And their guys have bought into their coach and their coaches, you know, dream and vision for the program. And, you know, a team that has been underappreciated. I'm not going to say underrated, but I think underappreciated for a long time because of, you know, where they've been playing in their conference, and they haven't been able to knock down that door. So, I mean, what an amazing story for Cabrini between the Timmy Brooks stuff we've talked about a lot. You know, so many little things that made their season so special, overcoming York and beating Salisbury, and, you know, the Timmy Brooks kid having the opportunity to go in and play significant minutes after not having played for a long time due to an injury because the starter goes down on basically the first play of the game. I mean, these are things you can't write about. I'm a big believer in fate dating back to the 2012 Baltimore Ravens when Ray Lewis announced his retirement. It was just meant to be, and I think there was this intangible quality that Cabrini had, and but there's no doubt that from head to toe, they were the most complete team. And we'll dive into the X's and O's of this game, but was just super impressed with their ability to make plays in a timely fashion.
Josh, that concept of hope, I think, really is the key story to all of this. And, you know, Coach Colfer talked about this in the post-game press conference, and then he and I talked a little more at length after that. And one of the things that really struck me is every year that there was a first-time participant in championship weekend, he said he would send that coach an email, basically, congrats for your season, congrats for making it this far, because it gave him hope. You know, it gave him hope that what I'm doing is going to pay off in some tangible way, getting to this milestone that, you know, obviously you want to win it, but getting to championship weekend is such a big deal in our sport. He would always send these coaches these emails about, you know, how proud he was and how much it gave him, it motivated him, it gave him hope to keep going. This time, you know, Coach Steve Kadelka, who we had on this podcast, sent Coach Colfer an email the day before the championship, somewhere in that championship weekend time period, saying, "Coach, this is the email you sent me when we were going to the championship for the first time. Here's my message to you." And it's just really talks about that camaraderie that these guys have and how much everyone, we all want to win, but everyone wants to see other people succeed, good people succeed, and also just see the sport grow and succeed in meaningful ways. So that was really a special thing that stood out to me. And really the other thing, you know, when we're talking about post-game and you know, I'm always more interested in the emotional, the human aspect of it. Kyle, I know you lean a little more toward the X's and O's, but what Colfer said about he gave his post-game speech Thursday before the championship because he didn't want to have to give it, you know, in the locker room when people are crying because they just lost, or in the locker room because everyone's, you know, jumping up and down, listening to music because they just won, because the guys aren't going to hear him there. There's going to be pulled in different directions for interviews, all those things. So he gave it on Thursday, and basically what he said was, "I love all of you, win or lose. I'm not going to love you more. I'm not going to love you less." He has 19 years of people that he's affected in that way, and that's what he said. There's going to be 19 years of alums who are going to be meeting us at the tailgate, and you can see I love those guys just as much, whether they had a successful season or they didn't. That was a really strong message that he gave, and Timmy Brooks reiterated that message. He sent Coach Colfer a text message before the game that said, "What you're doing, it's working." Obviously, it worked on Sunday in the championship game. Really just special all around. One of the more intriguing championships that I've ever been a part of in terms of covering. This is my 9th championship weekend that I've been at. Really special, meaningful one. Let's talk about it on the field a little bit. Kyle, how did this shakedown that maybe was different than what you expected, maybe was the same, ultimately, what did this game swing on?
I think it was a lot of face-offs. And in turn, a lot of possessions that were either extended with saved shots or pipe shots or little micro fouls, and it was in favor of Cabrini. And I think what I expected going into the game is that it would go the other way. And I really felt like Amherst just didn't get going at the speed they wanted, because every time they would threaten to go on a run, you know, Cabrini just win a faceoff, bring it down, and score. And they did it over and over and over, stacked their leads and their stops against an Amherst team that was their calling card. So I think it was just a matter of momentum. And I don't think the Mammoths ever got it. And, you know, I think it's interesting, like, you say, like, I'm more X's and O's than emotion. And I probably come off like that, but that's not the reality of the situation. I mean, when you were talking about what Colfer was saying to his kids, I'm just thinking back to when I was coaching, what I would say to my kids. And, you know, that's kind of a part of the message, is that, yes, I never got anywhere close to this level of championship contention, but really when the season ends, you want the kids to know that you care about them. And if you don't send that message, I don't think you're a good coach. And I don't think you're a good dude either. So I think that that's huge, that we had two great coaches in this final. And getting to know Coach Thompson, I'm totally comfortable saying, like, he's a good person as well as a good coach. And like after the game, I went down to the press box, and I didn't stay for Cabrini. I just wanted to see, you know, how those guys were doing. And I saw Coach Thompson afterwards, and, you know, I'm not going to lie to you, we hugged it out a little bit, and I'm holding back some tears, but like, I understand now, you know, and I feel like getting to know that team has made everything that I've tried to do with this D2 and D3 coverage better, because it means something to me and it means something to them. And that's why I really enjoyed everything we've done this year. And it was tough to see Amherst lose, but dude, if you're going to lose to a team that is like one of the greatest redemption stories. And I'm not even talking about the Timmy Brooks stuff. It all goes back to Cabrini finally getting over the hump, getting the wins they need, and delivering in a championship game. And for a team that's never been there, man, they didn't play like it, you know?
Yeah, Kyle, by more X's and O's, I mean, you're actually good at X's and O's, and I am not, is what it comes down to. Josh Cabrini, you know, what Kyle said, getting over the hump, how do you perceive what this means for Cabrini, what it means for D3, just in terms of, you know, it was joked about that, you know, Cabrini's going to choke. They're not going to get past Salisbury. They did. We talked about hope, but just thinking more about Cabrini, what do you think this can propel them to?
That's a good question. I think that there's always going to be a piece of when you're on such a national stage in terms of where it can propel them to, it's always going to be great for recruiting and for taking the next step. And when you've reached that highest point you could possibly reach, it's going to be hard for any 20, 21-year-old kid to not be content, right? I remember, you know, when Lynchburg made that team in 2015, they made that run and made the national championship team. You know, the expectations are really high now, and there's a target on your back. And not that there wasn't for Cabrini before, but like I said, I think they were a little bit underappreciated. But in terms of recruiting, you know, especially in the backyard, where I feel like there'd be a lot of arguments made, but I think Philly, you know, it'd be tough to make an argument that there's a bigger and better, more talent coming out of Philly in terms of lacrosse than anywhere else in the country. Certainly more than Baltimore right now. You know, Long Island is always there. But to have this game played in Philly, be right in your backyard, in terms of propelling them to the next level, you know, they're going to draw some talent they might not ordinarily get. They're going to, you know, kids are going to be looking and Googling Cabrini and finding out what majors they have and stuff like that. And it's a huge opportunity for them to take this and run with it. You know, we used to always talk about in college, like, these are your test marks. You want to get 10 on your bench and that. And, you know, they've hit 10, and now it's like, all right, you're going to stop at 10 and take a break, or are you going to just keep pushing and pushing and pushing through? So, you know, hopefully this isn't their ceiling for them, and they can turn this into an opportunity where they're back and they don't get content. But in terms of putting on them a map, like I said, they were underappreciated. You know, Cabrini has always been a good team. They've always been a top 10 team for as long as I can remember, especially in the last 4 years. You know, I was talking to a coach before the game, and, you know, it's crazy to think that we were talking about them as little as we were, because they have been one of the most consistent teams for the last 10, 15 years. They've had some amazing kids. Some of the best attackmen ever to play Division III lacrosse have come out of Cabrini in the last 10 years. The Jordan Krug kid is probably the highlight for them. So, you know, it's really cool, and I want to get into a little bit of more of the statistics of this and the X's and O's and break down, like, you know, each individual play and runs, and but it is what cool one. Not to get too emotional about it, like Kyle was talking about, but, you know, my favorite part of the whole weekend is just watching those teams celebrate. You know, I had dreamed about, as a senior and junior in college, you know, winning a national championship and going to find my dad in the stands and giving him a hug, and that's what's so cool is that, you know, Kyle and I both, between coaching and playing, like, you know how much you put into it. And the ultimate reward is to eventually be holding that trophy up and, you know, win your last game, right? The goal is to win your last game. So I'm really excited for those guys. I think that, like I said, in terms of hope, Cabrini gives some of those other schools that have been knocking on the door, you know, some hope that, hey, we get the right pieces, the right little momentum, the right leaders in our locker room. We clean this, that, and the other up. Why can't this be us? And I think that's really cool, you know, as sort of an inspiration for some other programs.
Talking a little more specifically about the game, Kyle Tucker was named the championship game most outstanding player. He had 3 goals and an assist. Jordan Krug was as good as advertised. 2 goals on 3 assists. I think maybe he has pretty balanced stat numbers, but I think people perceive him, just because of his size and physicality, as a, I'm going to get to the net and score guy, and that's it. He's totally not that. He's able to use his body to get in a good position, draw some action, and make the feed. Really showcase that in this game. Timmy Brooks, 2 goals. 1 was the game winner. He stepped in for injury, which has been a theme of this Cabrini team all year. Remember, they had, I believe, 2 All-Americans hurt preseason or early in the season, that people had to step up and find new roles on this team. Riley White played fantastic, 11 saves. Tommy DeLuca, who really, I think, he's a junior. He's going to be a senior next year. Probably one of the better defenders in Division III lacrosse next year. He had 5 ground balls. Really complete. You know, all of these guys playing, I won't say the best game of their life, but every guy playing at an elevated level really led to this. And Kyle, for me, you know, you talked about Amherst not really getting going. I kind of thought they did early. They didn't hit that fifth gear, though. They were kind of like cruising along in third or fourth gear. Didn't really take it into overdrive. Cabrini gets that span of 58 or a minute and 2 seconds where they get 3 goals back to back to back. That tied the game. That really switched the momentum so much in Cabrini's favor. And really kind of from that point, it felt like they were in control of the pace of this game. Kyle, one point we've talked about so much and I think is key into this game is Amherst D middies. How was Cabrini able to kind of overcome that talent at that position?
So I think what they did is they spread real wide and tried to isolate any number of guys, not just the short stick demonies. I think they did it with a couple pulls as well to try and pull guys out. And one of the reasons they did that is not just to dodge one guy. They wanted to pull another defender out so they could bang the ball over the top or underneath to the other side for a shot. And that's what a lot of their early goals were. I think after that turning point that you mentioned, the game tire, they went into kind of a different offense where Cabrini did, where they would kind of, instead of banging the ball, they would see if they could draw the slide. And it was a little different in terms of Amherst's ability to adjust to that was a little behind. And by the time they did, they were down 2 more goals. And they really, I do think the key to the game was that Amherst just couldn't get the ball after that particular event. You know, it just wasn't, nothing came up for them. It seemed like, not that Cabrini didn't like get a ton of bounces, they worked for those bounces. I don't believe in teams just being awarded bounces by the gods of lacrosse. I think that they worked for all of them. And Amherst did as well, but they didn't get them. And huge, you know, you saw a couple overthrown passes. You saw a bunch of bodies flying everywhere at one point. I think kind of late in the third quarter, things got a little crazy. But, you know, by and large, Cabrini just straight up outplayed them. And the hard thing is, I don't think many teams have done that this year, aside from Williams and Tufts once. You know, I mean, look at the teams that Amherst lost to. Look at the teams that Cabrini lost to. That's not going to define them. Do you know what I mean? I feel like their successes here getting to this game are so easily celebrated and should be celebrated. They weren't like a product of a good bracket seeding, which is like what people are using as a determining factor in a lot of other tournaments, shall we say, at the college level. I think they both defied expectations and really put a cap on one of the best seasons that I can remember.
Absolutely. One of the best seasons that I can remember as well at the Division III level. Such fun, such a good, like you said, redemption story, not just Tim Brooks, but just their ability to bounce back from injuries, to stay focused on the ultimate goal, to avenge their losses that they had in the regular season. Really everything added up to a really special moment.
Yeah, from not like X's and O's, but just the notes that I had kind of taken down that really made Cabrini really special today and throughout the season, in no particular order. You know, starting with like kind of Amherst, I felt like they seemed a little forced. I think they're a team that got here by playing really free flowing and fast and willing to take chances, and it seemed a little more structured than I was used to. And I felt that Cabrini played the opposite of that. I think they were loose, they were willing to take chances, understanding the risk reward, the ebbs and flows of the games, and those 2-3 goal runs they had ended up being the difference in this game. A kid I want to give a shout out to is Robert Cressman, number 16 D middie for Cabrini. I was in a box and there were a bunch of other guys, you know, ironically, who were D3 guys who had graduated in the, you know, 80s and 90s from Washington College and Salisbury's and some of those. And this 16 kid, this Cressman kid, was talked about probably more than anyone. His ability to clear the ball, I think he had 4 clears. He had at least 1 or 2 calls turnovers. he was a monster for them. You know, as Cabrini went in and out of their zone, they would hold this big orange sign up that was literally not like the color orange, but like the fruit of an orange that would mean like go to their zone. And he just was physical, and he got on guys' hands as they were dodging down the alley. Seemed to be a real spark plug for them. He had some great clears where, you know, he maybe had a swim move or a spin that maybe was necessary, maybe wasn't, but either way, it got the crowd into it, injected energy into the team, and Cabrini kind of just built off of that. I think three other things quickly to hit on is, you know, the Jacob Klein injury in the first 10 seconds really speaks to the depth that Cabrini had. You know, we talked about depth for Amherst, but the depth on Cabrini, obviously we were talking about the Timmy Brooks kid who came in and played for them, but they got a handful of different guys into this game that were not as talked about as they probably should have been. And that just goes to the depth that Coach Colfer has created there and how deep their bench goes. The last two things I want to say that were big were the number seven, Tyler Kostak kid, his ability to create space. He had one of the quickest first steps I've seen D1 do D2, D3 all weekend. His ability to just create space and either step in and score a goal or two, or then two or three passes later, Amherst having to slide and get to the backside for an open shot for Cabrini, I think was a huge part of this game. His ability to draw two and get out of his stick quick was amazing. And I think if you saw, as the shot clock wound down for Cabrini, you would see a midfielder towards the top sort of breaking towards the box. I think that Cabrini really wanted to hang their hat on not giving up those transition goals that had gotten Amherst to where they are. Amherst really wanted to play 5-on-5, 5-on-4, quick whistles. They didn't want to run the shot clock down to, you know, 8-7 seconds. And I think Cabrini realized that quickly. So they were subbing middies off. You know, once Cabrini got under 10 seconds in the shot clock, they were willing to let their guys take a dive or take a shot that's not a really high-quality shot in order to get one of their midfielders off quickly, sub the Cressman kid or a pull on early to get back into the hole, not to give up transition, which, you know, in the most basic way, that's what got Amherst there. That's, you know, where their money's at is their transition. And Cabrini just all across just seemed so much more comfortable, just made more plays in a timely manner, and just they, you know, not to like get super cliche because they weren't playing Philly, but they just looked like they were playing in their backyard. You could tell they were not afraid of anyone, and they held nothing back.
Congrats to Cabrini. An excellent season, an excellent story, excellent game they played to win the national title. Merrimack ending its reign in Division II as national champions. They beat Limestone 16-8 on Sunday at Lincoln Financial Field. What a fitting end to the Merrimack Warriors' run in Division II. Next year, they're going to be a member of the NEC Conference in Division I. They're going to have to wait a few years before they're eligible for postseason contention. But they have a team that has a lot of athletic, really good players who are going to lead them in this transition. Talking about this game, Kyle, I think we have to start at the faceoff X, which I feel like I'm kind of repeating myself here. Davis Cronin, he won 18 of 27 faceoffs. He's a sophomore. This is not how we scripted this game to go whatsoever. What do we see there?
No, I just think that Merrimack, I said before the game, I said leading up to the game, you know, faceoffs have been a problem. That's their Achilles heel, and they totally overcame it. And it wasn't just, you know, Cronin taking draws. It was the wing play. It was the aggressive ride. It didn't seem like that didn't look like the Limestone team I watched for 2 weeks. Even when they struggled against Tampa, they still were able to score and came back and obviously won that game. But they didn't look like they could score against Merrimack, and they also definitely couldn't stop Charlie Bertrand, because even when you shut him off, he still somehow was the second pass to a wide open goal for, you know, one of the Thomas brothers or even Sean Black. I think Sean Black was one of the best players in the game, had 2 and 3, but probably could have had double that. Just one of those great championship performances. Seamus Ford's goal kind of came against the run of play where he ISO'd to X and inverted, and he took a shot barely breaking GLE that hit the far side of the pipe and bounced in with such velocity and like confidence that I don't think I saw a better goal other than an OT winner or an OT tire the rest of the weekend. It was incredible. I think I put on Twitter, it was a face melter. Absolute face melter goal. I knew when that went in, it was way over. I just don't think Limestone valued their possessions enough. And they had a chance to kind of hold Merrimack down with a couple long ones, and they couldn't end those with scores. And if you can't end your possessions with scores against Merrimack, you're going to lose, because they surely will end theirs.
I don't have too many takes on this, but I think that the Charlie Bertrand kid is, I mean, he should be playing PLL or ML this summer. He is unbelievable. I guess he's not a senior, is he?
He's a junior.
No,
that's a problem for D1 teams next year.
Yeah.
He is going to be a problem. He is unbelievable. I mean, Kyle, I think you said it, or you said on this podcast, or someone in the suite that we were with mentioned that he had coached him when he was little. He could be a first line, second line attackman, midfielder at a Big Ten or ACC school. He is the real deal. The difference in this game, you know, it was 3-3 with 13:25 left in the second quarter, and at halftime it was 9-3. That 6-goal run was huge. And as a coach, whenever I'm down, you know, you're down at halftime, you're like, all right, hey, let's get the first one, and then, you know, you kind of just need that Kobe Bryant, see the ball to go in one time, and that opens up and you get a lot of confidence. And I think Mercyhurst, even though Limestone went on a run right out, I'm sorry, Merrimack, even though Merrimack, or I'm sorry, even though Limestone scored 4 goals pretty quickly in the third quarter, Merrimack scoring that first goal in the third quarter, making it 10-3, I just think takes so much wind out of your sails. You're like, all right, we'll regroup at halftime. We're going to get the first one and then the next one, 1 goal at a time. And that's just a killer in terms of momentum and some of that hope you talked about. And, you know, a 4-goal run to end the game and a 7-goal run in between the second and third quarter, you know, you got to do everything else perfect to overcome something like that. And Limestone wasn't able to do that.
Merrimack, they were the number 6 seed in the tournament, believe it or not. So they needed 3 straight road wins to win in the expanded D2 tournaments, the first year that it's been expanded to this size. And they kind of took on the underdog mentality, which I don't really buy. You know, Merrimack is, I think, clearly one of the top 2, maybe 3 most talented teams in the North. Clearly, they were the best team at the end of the year. Kyle, we talked about Charlie and his ability at the next level. He's a freak, 6'3", 220 pounds, also really smart kid, mechanical engineering major, has a super high GPA, does everything right.
He won like the academic award for D2 or something, right?
Yeah, the Elite 80 Award. He was the winner for Merrimack. And Kyle, they're going to move to the NEC. Obviously, I know that they're not going to be in postseason contention because of the rules about transitioning. How good of a D1 team can this be from the start next year with the personnel that they have? How good can this team be at the D1 level, you know, 5, 10 years down the road, you know, as it kind of gets used to it and gets some more recruits and all those resources?
Well, first of all, I want to go back to what I feel was a slightly veiled New England sports fan Patriots dig about teams trying to be underrated to motivate themselves. You're not wrong. Just wanted to address it. I felt it. I think that Merrimack going into the NEC, I mean, this was actually, if you look at this season alone for the NEC, it was a pretty competitive conference. I think there were a lot of surprise wins, teams taking blood off each other in that conference. They're, you know, they're all fighting for that, the AQ there. I think that's probably not the best situation for Merrimack to go into as a new team, but I feel like they can definitely handle, you know, playing in at that level after watching this game. I mean, I know I said this before on the podcast. Last year, I would have, you know, bet, you know, my life, my family's life on Merrimack winning. I did not feel that way this year, but I probably should have. Anytime you doubt the Mac, they come back and they don't just like beat you. They slap you in the face and walk over your passed out body on the way to the trophy. Like, that's how this team plays. They're not going to change. They're going to go in and make enemies on the first game. Mark my words. And I guarantee you, no matter what these coaches said, and I know J.B. Clark kind of had a little fun with this, every D2 coach that has, or team that has played against Merrimack, is very happy to see the backside of Merrimack out of the conference. There is no doubt in my mind. And that's not just because they're very good. It's because they're really good at getting under your skin. And Anyone that plays in the NE10 that doesn't play for Merrimack absolutely hates Merrimack. Over, I'm just saying over LeMoyne, yes. Because LeMoyne, they're like, all right. I mean, you know, you've done it. And you're not, they're not really chirpy. I mean, Merrimack will tell you how good they are and how bad you are at the same time when they're playing. That's just their personality. That's their team. There are teams like that in D1 too. It's just that Merrimack happens to win championships with that attitude. I don't think they're going to win the NEC in the first year at all, but I think they're going to do a lot better than people think they are off the bat. And if they can continue getting the steady stream of recruits that they've got for the last couple years, especially getting them to the D2 championship, you know, I think that they can build on that. You know, I just think they need a little bit more size and a few more specialists, and they're right there with every team in that conference.
Mount St. Mary's, Hobart, Sacred Heart, Robert Morris, St. Joseph's, Bryant, Wagner. Over under 3 wins in conference for Merrimack next year. Or push.
I honestly push. I think 3 is realistic. I'm not, again, I said this last week and I'm glad it paid off, but I do believe it. I don't bet against Morgan. So a push is not betting against him. So I'm taking that.
If you said a 2.5 odd, I would bet the over.
That's exactly why I said 3, because I'm looking at this conference and I'm like, 3 is exactly right. So I was, look, man, I'm trying to test you guys.
For comparison's sake, St. Joe's was 3-3 this year. St. Joe's, this was a down year for them. You know, they had a huge senior class graduate last year. They had a really good faceoff specialist come in that probably bought them a few wins. They were 3-3 in the conference. Bryant was 1-5, and Bryant is not going to go 1-5 in most years. Wagner is kind of the team down there that's going 0-6. They're still kind of in rebuilding mode with a new coach. Sacred Heart had 4 wins, and we've seen Sacred Heart has one of the best players in Division I lacrosse.
Yep.
I'm not saying this to say that Merrimack is not going to be on their level. I'm just saying that the challenge ahead, you know, the NEC, you know, people may look at it like it's not the greatest conference, but you put Max Tuttle from Sacred Heart against anyone in the country. You put, you know, some of the guys that St. Joe's graduated last year against anybody in the country, there's some star power in this conference. So, but I think Merrimack's good, and I think they'll steal a win against a team that they shouldn't, and they'll beat at least one team. So that 2.5 is probably the money line right there.
Well, Matt, let me ask you then. What team has an individual player that's better than Charlie Bertrand in the NEC? And who is it?
Tuttle graduated, correct?
Tuttle's gone.
No one.
Right? How crazy is that we're saying that?
The kid from Mount St. Mary's, right? Magnan, he graduates.
Yep.
Yeah. Bertram's the best player in the NEC. As a senior, too, right? He'll be a senior next year.
Right.
Yeah.
I was going to say Tyson Gibson from Robert Morris, but he's a senior. I think he took a huge star turn this year. Hobart, Eric Holden. Might be better. He's on the same level as him, at the very least. Hobart's got a few really good players. Jason Knox, their freshman's a really good finisher. Doesn't have the same diverse skill set as Bertrand, but in terms of playing his role, he's certainly up there with them. But yeah, I mean, Kyle, that's an excellent point. Like, he's a senior too. Joe Sagisi at Sacred Heart. Logan, and I'm going to butcher his last name. He has a very Nordic last name. Logan Liljeberg from Sacred Heart is up there as well. But he's certainly in that conversation. He's going to be a guy that's going to compete for, I don't know if he's technically eligible with the way that their transition works, but he'll be a guy competing for first team NEC attackman, no doubt.
That's so cool. I mean, that's what, you know, as a D, Kyle, you and me as D2, D3 guys, having someone go up there and punish some D1's team and showing them how much talent at the top of the charts there are for D2 and D3 is just like, gets me so fired up.
Yeah, it doesn't happen often, but I'm very much looking forward to it happening.
Awesome. Well, this has been a fun run. I think we'll do a few more podcasts before we kind of call it a summer, maybe something looking forward to 2020, maybe something recapping the rules. We'll do a few things here, but thank you for listening all year. We've really enjoyed doing this week to week. We've really enjoyed, you know, I think we're proud of what we've done and the impact we've made on the sport. We appreciate some of the comments, some of the criticisms, and all the feedback that everyone has given. We look forward to another great year, a fun off season, and you know, you love what you do. You don't have to work a day in your life. That's certainly the case for the three of us. So thanks for all the support.
This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.